Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'd request 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, when a person stands on the front porch of a residence and is approached by police responding to an anonymous tip, and he hollers out, and the person next to him flees, but this person who hollered remains, cooperates with the police, does everything they ask, he does not create a reasonable suspicion that he is involved in criminal activity. And he certainly does not create a reasonable suspicion that he is armed. Therein lies the first two propositions of law that Lenoris Jordan comes before the court and proposes today. The third proposition of law, which I know is of interest to this court, not only in this case, but in others, and is also going to be the primary focus of my remarks in Elvin Fingers' case, which comes next, concerns post-release control. But with respect to propositions of law 1 and 2, these are cutting-edge issues for this court with respect to the Fourth Amendment. Proposition of law 1 concerns the validity of the investigative detention to which Mr. Jordan was subjected. Proposition of law 2 concerns the propriety of the frisk or the pat-down for weapons. As this court is well aware, but unfortunately as the trial court failed to grasp, those are two separate considerations. One does not flow immediately from the other. Each must be based on a reasonable suspicion, as the Supreme Court has defined that term. In Illinois versus Wardlow, the United States Supreme Court, by a bare majority of 5-4, set forth that reasonable suspicion could be gathered by a person's unprovoked fleeing from the police. Four justices of the United States Supreme Court dissented from that view. In this case, the 8th District has taken Wardlow one step further. And it has said that the person who did not flee, albeit the person who hollered out something, but then remained and cooperated, would somehow be reasonably suspected of it being involved in drug activity.
In what way did he cooperate?
He cooperated, Your Honor, in that he submitted to all the police requests. He was on the front porch.
Did he tell them who fled? Did they ask him that? Did he tell them?
There's no evidence that they ever asked, Your Honor.
That would be the ultimate cooperation, wouldn't it?
Well,
that
Your
was
Honor,
Leroy that just bolted.
Your Honor, that would have been, I suppose, the ultimate cooperation short of tackling them and keeping them there.
Yeah.
But the thing, Your Honor, is this. With respect to the Fourth Amendment seizure, the Fourth Amendment seizure occurs when the police come up to the vicinity of where Mr. Jordan remains, and they said, come on over here. They asked him a couple of questions. First, they said, we heard there was some drug activity around here and that there was a blue car. And he said, well, that's my car. He cooperated by telling them the answers to the question they asked. That's my car. They asked him to come over, and he came over so that they could, they said, come on over here, we want to pat you down, and he came over and he was patted down. Which moves to proposition of law number 2. There was no reasonable suspicion to justify that pat down.
Person that fled, if they caught him, they would be able to search him.
Your Honor, with respect to the person who fled, if they caught him, they would have had a right to detain him by virtue of the fact that Wardlow.
The right to detain him and talk to him, no search.
With respect to the pat down, Your Honor, it would have depended on the totality of the circumstances as they evolved in their subsequent conversation and seizure of that person. Wardlow did not address.
But you feel that the mere fact that the person ran from the scene when he saw the police does not give the police the right to search him?
That in and of itself would not be sufficient to justify a protective pat down, Your Honor. And Wardlow,
What would the police have to add to the person running away, catch him? What does the police then have to show that they had a right then to search him?
The police would look to the evasive nature of, you know, where he ran. Did he try to hide something along the way? For example, as this court had in State versus Bobo, where there was furtive movements that were consistent with hiding a weapon. Something like that would have caused reasonable suspicion to believe that this person was armed. And Wardlow did not address that issue. Wardlow specifically focused, from what we know. Yes, Your Honor.
The mere fact of running away from the scene is not sufficient cause then.
The mere fact of running away from the scene without more would not be sufficient cause. If it was dark, if it was night, that would have added to the suspicion. But there was no evidence in this case. The prosecutor never adduced any evidence of the time of day in this case. The prosecutor never adduced any evidence. There was no evidence that they were able to adduce, going back to my client for a second, of what was hollered.
Did the police question the defendant as to whether he knew that person or the activities of the other person?
Nothing in the record that suggests that they did, Your Honor. Nothing in the record that suggests that in the course of their investigation.
So we don't know whether he even knew the man.
Your Honor, other than the fact that they were in proximity to each other on the front porch, there was no evidence as to what their relationship was. There was no evidence as to what it was that my client hollered out. And while the police officer speculated that it was hollered out to the companion, the fact of the matter is the officer couldn't tell what it was that had been hollered. Your Honors, while when it comes to the person who remains behind, when it comes to my client, there is nothing to justify a pat-down for weapons other than the officer's comment that in his experience it is common for people involved in drugs to be involved in weapons. Your Honors, that type of bright line test has never been adopted by the United States Supreme Court, has never been adopted by this court. It runs afoul of the totality of the circumstances test that has become time-worn in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. In State versus Bobo, this court looked at seven different factors that were apparent in that particular case. The factors that this court found to be particular to the individual, and there is the key, because the reasonable suspicion must be particular to the individual to be searched. And this court looked at the fact that in that case, that particular individual made motions with respect to trying to hide something under a front seat, that particular officer was able to say, I've seen those types of particular motions before. They are consistent with hiding a weapon. That was not present here. All we have here is an officer saying it is common. In Ibarra versus Illinois, the United States Supreme Court, in a different setting, was concerned with who could be patted down when a search warrant was being executed at a bar, a very small bar, for drugs. Now, there was probable cause in that case to believe that there were drugs present. We're not talking about reasonable suspicion. There was probable cause with respect to the fact that drugs were present. And yet, the United States Supreme Court said it would not adopt a bright line rule that would allow for the pat down of everyone in the bar. Interestingly, in that case, Chief Justice Rehnquist's dissent at 444 U.S., page 106. Chief Justice Rehnquist talked about the fact in his dissent that drugs and guns go together, that guns are the tool of the trade. And yet, a majority of the Supreme Court of the United States was not willing to adopt that type of bright line rule. As a matter of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, nor should this court. And as a matter of Ohio constitutional law regarding search and seizure, we would ask this court to go even further and to adopt the minority view, the dissenting view, in Illinois versus Wardlow, which would, of course, cause us to prevail on proposition of law one under any reading of Wardlow. And although we maintain that we win under Illinois versus Wardlow as well with respect to proposition of law number one. With respect to proposition of law number two, and this notion of weapons and how they relate and the frisk for weapons, bright line rules, while nice in some ways for lawyers who are looking to see what the rule of law is, whether we be defense attorneys or prosecutors, bright line rules fail to recognize that the type of suspicion that the Fourth Amendment looks at, that Terry versus Ohio and its progeny look at, is an individualized, particularized suspicion.
Well, the police were investigating the sale of drugs.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they located this porch because there was a blue Pontiac, which they also located. So presumably a sale would involve two people, one buyer, one seller, at a minimum. And why wouldn't it be reasonable for them to conclude if there were two males, one of whom left, the other of whom would either be the buyer or the seller? And why couldn't they pursue that on reasonable suspicion, particularly when they had some evidence of a vehicle which they'd located?
Because, Your
Honor,
what's
unreasonable about that?
Your Honor, because the information on which that was based was an anonymous tip. And Florida versus JL has stated that when all that is present is an anonymous tip as to the general things of there's a person in a particular place. In Florida versus JL, it was a person with a plaid shirt. And the anonymous tip was he's going to be carrying a gun. And the United States Supreme Court said that is not enough for reasonable suspicion. Justice Kennedy put it very well in his concurring opinion, I believe, in that case, where he talked about the fact that the anonymous tipster can lie with impunity. That the anonymous tipster, because there is no accountability to the police.
Well, in that case, those gentlemen were just standing at a bus stop. In this case, you have one of them who fled upon hearing some warning, presumably, issued by another, giving some credence to the fact that the report that the police were responding to had some credibility to it.
Well, and
at least
of course,
an inference that way.
Your Honor, there is a couple things to your question there. I want to make sure I get them all. With respect to the warning, of course, as I've mentioned before, the evidence doesn't support that it was a warning. The evidence supports that something was said. It was just as likely it was said to the people coming, since it was hollered out, as it would be to the person who was right next to my client at the time. But with respect to that totality, that there was an anonymous tip of drugs, that one person fled, while my person remains back, my client remains present. In that, Wardlow represents the bare minimum of what Fourth Amendment jurisprudence will allow with respect to a reasonable suspicion. To go beyond Wardlow is to go too far. Now, the police, that doesn't mean that the police can't come up and talk to Mr. Jordan. They can engage in a consensual police-citizen encounter. But they cannot, at that moment, seize him under the Fourth Amendment. That is to say, to place him in a position where a reasonable person would not feel free to leave. But could they have spoken to him? Yes. And Mr. Justice O'Donnell, with respect to your question, I'm not suggesting that it would have been improper for the police to continue their investigation. But the question becomes, under what parameters is that investigation to be continued? And it should have been continued as a consensual encounter, not as an investigative detention. Moreover, it would still not justify, even as an investigative detention, it would still not justify the frisk for weapons, because that requires further reasonable suspicion. Mr. Chief Justice, I realize that I have a whopping 5 seconds left for rebuttal, and so I better...
You better stop now
and use that wisely.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Williamson.
Unless the court has any other questions.
Ms. Williamson.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Lisa Williamson from the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. On behalf of State of Ohio, in these two cases that the court will hear, and I'd like to thank you for accepting for review these issues that are presented in each of these cases. And with the court's indulgence, I'd like to address first the post-release control issues that are presented by Mr. Jordan to this court. And I will address, of course, the search issues as presented by Mr. Martin. In Jordan, Mr. Jordan pled no contest to one felony five drug possession case after denial of his suppression motion. And post-release control is discretionary for that type of offense. It's discretionary with the parole board. The trial court did not provide any type of advisory regarding post-release control at either the no contest plea or at the sentencing that took place thereafter. And what the court held was that the case was remanded for resentencing to advise of post-release control. And in this case, Mr. Jordan is saying that the trial court or the reviewing court erred in reversing and remanding this for resentencing. However, the state posits that this was an appropriate determination by the trial court for a number of reasons. First of all, I'd like to point out that we have two divergent decisions by the District Court of Appeals, which demonstrates some difficulty or the difficulty in dealing with these types of cases. In Finger, under similar circumstances, the court reached the opposite result. The court held that Mr. Finger was exempt from post-release control. And I'd like to present to this court the reasons why an offender should be resentenced when there is an error in the post-release control advisory or where there is no post-release advisory at all. Oddly enough, the 8th District resolved both of these cases using this court's authority in Woods versus Telb to support their divergent decisions. In Jordan, the court held that Woods versus Telb requires the advisory either at the time of the plea or at the time of the sentencing, and that the court could do nothing other than to reverse and remand for a resentencing. What we do know is that in Woods versus Telb, this court said three things regarding post-release control that is germane to the decisions this morning. First, that post-release control is an actual part of each sentence. It's not an extension, it's not an addition, it's an actual part of the sentence. The trial courts are required to advise at the time of the plea or the sentencing that post-release control is an actual part of the sentence. And I'll explain that further, but that depends on whether or not a person is pleading guilty or whether or not a person has gone to trial and is being sentenced as to what type of advisory they receive. And lastly, this court held that Revised Code 2967-28, the post-release control statute, does not violate the separation of powers doctrine nor the due process clauses of the state and federal constitutions. In State versus Beasley in
Yes. I believe it was the Finger case where the trial or the court appeals said that since the trial court hadn't imposed post-release control, they no longer could.
Yes.
Correct. What would then, if we were to accept that rationale, what would prevent courts that didn't like post-release control, didn't want to be bothered with it, from simply not imposing it, and there's no recourse?
And actually, that's happened, at least in my experience in the 8th District. There are jurists I know of who do not believe that post-release control is constitutional, believe that it is an additional sentence still to this day, despite this court's authority, and do not impose post-release control as part of a sentence. I'm involved in litigation in a case right now where the court came out and said, I'm not going to impose post-release control. I don't think it should be part of this person's sentence. And we've just appealed that to the 8th District Court of Appeals, so we're in the preliminary stages. But certainly, in answer to your question, it would be very easy for a court who did not like it to simply not impose it, and this person, this criminal defendant, would be forever precluded from serving that part of his sentence.
And so that would give the judge the power to ignore the legislative mandate that it be part of his sentence by simply not imposing it and the Court of Appeals saying, you don't do it, can't go back and resentence.
Absolutely, which imposes a number of constitutional questions and issues that certainly need to be addressed. First of all, when that happens, where there are offenders who are exempt from post-release control, due process guarantees are not imposed. It does not ensure fundamental fairness. It doesn't require adherence to the law, which is what due process requires. Secondly, it does not ensure equal protection guarantees. We have defendants, criminal defendants who are being sentenced. Every single one of them, for every single one of them, post-release control is a part of their sentence. Whether it's discretionary or mandatory is up to the statute, and where it's discretionary is up to the parole board.
Well, is it your view that every judge must impose post-release control in every case?
The court actually does not impose post-release control, but notifies of post-release control.
Excuse me, you're correct. Must the judge do that in every case, in your view?
Yes. In fact, that is required both under the statutory provisions as well as this court's holding in Woods versus Taub. What this court said in Taub is that because post-release control is an actual part of each sentence, a court must advise. That is, a court must tell an offender who is being sentenced that post-release control is an actual part of the sentence. For certain offenses, felonies 1s, 2s, certain sex offenses, post-release control is mandatory. For other offenses, post-release control is discretionary with the parole board. That notification is mandatory. Post-release control, in fact, may be discretionary, but this court has determined that a trial court has no discretion to impose post-release control and has no discretion to decide whether or not to notify. The notification is mandatory.
Thank you.
A couple other, just on the constitutional issues, there's a violation of equal protection because we're treating similar defendants differently when we, courts are allowed to exempt some offenders from post-release control. There's no rational relation to any state interest that I can think of there in exempting some criminal defendants from a mandatory statutory part of their sentence. And it's fundamentally unfair to treat different offenders differently for no reason other than the trial court made an inadvertent mistake and or a reviewing court happens not to like post-release control.
Now let's get back to the search.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's more important than this other issue. What did the defendant do that justified what the police did?
If I may answer your question by backing up just a little bit, the reason the police were there is that they did receive an anonymous complaint regarding the defendant standing on the porch. And the reason that they followed up on this was that they had certain information about a male on a porch who was selling drugs.
Had they been in the neighborhood before on other searches or other crimes being committed in that area? Do they have that knowledge?
As a matter of fact, I believe this particular officer testified that he had been an officer for 5 years and was familiar with the area. He had been in that area. I don't know if it was for the full 5 years, but he testified that it was a high crime and a high drug area.
Had he ever arrested anyone in that area?
Absolutely. I think he testified that he had responded to over 200, a couple of hundred drug complaints is the way that he phrased it.
He had 200 arrests?
He said he responded to over 200 drug complaints. He testified to arrest, but I don't think he gave the number of arrests that he had made.
Get back to what, I want to know what the defendant did to justify this.
That's what we're here for.
What had happened, again backing up, is that there was a complaint about a black male who was at a particular address, who was standing on the
all
porch.
All anonymous.
It was anonymous, yes. However, okay. There was...
What did he do when the police were on the scene that justified it?
The reasonable suspicion of criminal activity continued when this male shouted to another male, which caused the other male to run through the house and out the door.
What did he shout?
I don't think anybody testified as to hearing
it. Police didn't know either, right?
No, he didn't.
So
no.
that sort of negates that issue. They
well,
didn't know, they didn't know what he hollered.
No, they didn't know, but the police did not know what he hollered. However, what the police officer testified to was not only was he able to corroborate the information that was received through the anonymous complaint by reason of a number of factors, a make and model of a vehicle that was parked across the street, a specific address, a black male, a person standing on a porch, the fact that there was a person selling drugs.
Those observations are pretty common to any neighborhood.
But they're especially indicative of drug trafficking, especially in this officer's training and experience of responding to drug complaints.
So they went to the area with a preconceived idea that this is a drug area, that they're going to find drug people, and that they have a right then to proceed with the search of anyone.
No, certainly not, sir. They were following through with a complaint that there were two people on a porch, one a black male who was selling drugs. And given all of the factors that they got through an anonymous complaint, I think they were able to verify through their observation all of them, including
the vehicle. Okay, let's get back to what the defendant did.
Okay, the defendant, when they approached, their reasonable suspicion based on the officers, Martinez's reasonable suspicion of criminal activity based on his experience, based on his training, was alerted.
So they went up to the defendant with a preconceived notion, an idea that drug trafficking was going on.
Only after he had confirmed through his observations all of the factors, all of the facts that was provided through the anonymous complaint.
So he went up to the defendant with the idea of searching him to begin with.
He went up in order to determine whether or not there was, in fact, criminal activity based upon his observations and the complaint, which were confirmed. The complaint was confirmed through his observations.
Okay.
So, but what I'm saying is that his suspicion of criminal activity continued, and in fact, according to his testimony, was heightened.
Was the defendant cooperative?
The defendant didn't run. That was the extent of his cooperation.
Did he tell him, did he answer the questions that he was asked?
I believe that he did answer questions, but he didn't provide anything as far as what was going on and who the other person was.
Was he asked what was going on?
I don't think he asked the identity of the other person.
So he wasn't asked what was going on?
Well, I don't know that he was asked that particular question, sir. No,
okay.
I don't.
Go ahead.
I can't say that. However, this officer's suspicion continued after he confirmed through his observations the complaint. It continued by the shouting. He testified that this was consistent with a large quantity of drugs being involved because one person ran away. This was not innocuous behavior. This was behavior that he was used to seeing in drug trafficking activity, as one of the panel noted.
The shouting to the other person, which he didn't know what was shouted, indicated a large trafficking of drugs.
That's what he testified to, his suspicion that there was a large quantity of drugs was involved because one person took off, and that the shouting was not inconsistent with what, you know, with his experience. This scenario is resolved with the well-settled precedent of this court.
Are we through with what the defendant did?
I'm sorry?
Are we through with what the defendant did
at
the scene?
Yes, sir.
That's it?
Yes, he shouted to the other male, causing the other male to run.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm not through. I have one question. Is there any case that you know of that gives more weight to an anonymous call that comes from an area in which there has been a certain kind of criminal activity as a pattern, such as a drug area or their burglaries or whatever? Or the cases all look at the anonymous caller as not very credible?
I can't remember the name of the case, but I know there are cases that certainly distinguish the anonymous complaint. However, there are a number of cases that say where the police are able to confirm the complaint through their observations, it lends more credibility to the anonymous complaint. So that these officers were not going in solely with the information of an anonymous complaint. They were going in with an anonymous complaint and all of the facts provided in the anonymous complaint with their own observations. And basically that's what this court has said on many occasions in Andrews and Bobo and in Freeman, is that it's the officers' observations and their training and experience, the facts that unfold before them that give give them the reasonable suspicion to warrant the investigation, to warrant a Terry stop or even a Terry pat down.
You cite with favor Bobo?
Yes.
Well, I must tell you, I wasn't here when Bobo was decided, but a former colleague of mine frequently mentioned Bobo, Mr. Justice Wright, with great disdain as a mistake on the part of this court. I don't want to revisit that, but what's the racial texture of the neighborhood?
I don't recall that there was any testimony of that, Your Honor. I don't.
Well, you know the neighborhood.
Personally, I can tell you that it's a high crime area and probably a high drug area. That
what exactly was the neighborhood?
The 4th District of the Cleveland.
And where is that?
Well, it covers an area that is East 22nd to probably about to the Shaker Heights border, which is an eastern.
So it was on the east side?
It's on the east side of Cleveland, yes.
Well, I'm reading the facts here, and it says that the officer responded to a location at 2019 West 105th Street.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I thought it was east side. Just from my recollection of the case, I thought it was east side.
Well, you're standing here telling us the reason it was all right for, or what the confirmation of the anonymous tip was, that there was a black man, as if he was out of place in the neighborhood, on the front porch.
No, I didn't mean that at all. If I implied that, I didn't mean to imply that.
Well, that was one of the elements of confirmation.
It was one of the elements that there was a black male who was standing on a porch.
Well, but
he found, among other things.
The racial texture of the neighborhood might indicate that wouldn't be significant at all.
In coupled with the other elements.
With a blue car parked across the street. That's it.
Actually, I think that the record reflects that the car was parked in front of the address, but the my question is, he was asked to step off of the porch, and he did so voluntarily. Is that part of the cooperative element that you were discussing?
I suppose it could be. He certainly could be considered to be cooperative, yes.
And
he didn't run.
According to the appellate opinion, he was asked so that he could be checked for weapons. Now, is that the police actually stated to him, step off the porch so that we can check you for weapons?
I don't recall that the police said or told him, I need you to step off the porch to check for weapons. I don't recall that there was that testimony to check for weapons.
Well, it's in the appellate opinion.
Then that's what he said, I'm sure. If you're asking if that was part of the cooperativeness, yes, certainly it would be cooperative. I mean, he didn't run. He
so
didn't
he consented,
go anywhere.
He did he consent to the, I mean, can that be interpreted as a consent to the pat-down?
Probably not under those circumstances. I mean, the officer was going to conduct the pat down because of his suspicion of criminal activity and his knowledge of drug interactions and drug transactions and people who are involved in such activity to be carrying weapons, which is something that was documented with the court. I see that my time is up, and I'd like to apologize to the court for my mischaracterization of the location of this event. I was focusing on the post-release control issues, and I apologize. I didn't mean to mislead the court in any way.
Thank you, Ms. Williams.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Your Honor, I thank the court for its kindness. With respect to the issue of whether or not it could possibly be argued that the pat-down was consensual, the answer to that would be no, Your Honor, and the reason why is this. And first of all, it should be noted that the Court of Appeals treated this, as did both parties, as an investigative detention, that there was a Fourth Amendment seizure when the officers, having seen the defendant on the porch, having come into that vicinity, began to talk to him, and then they said to him, we asked him to step off the porch so that we could check him for weapons. Mm-hmm. That was at paragraph 33 of the opinion, which was in Judge Cooney's dissenting opinion. And so, Your Honor, at that point, having been told, come over here so that we can patch you for weapons effectively, the seizure that has taken place is such that at that point, the Fourth Amendment action has occurred. The Fourth Amendment has been invoked. And so accordingly, Your Honor, it cannot be considered a consensual pat down because at that point, the seizure has already taken place. Your Honors, with respect, Your Honor, I think I've gone over 30 seconds at this point,
yes.
And I appreciate the court's kindness, and I don't want to wear it out for the next argument. Thank you very much,
Your
Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.